This episode of Social Power was recorded on the 4th of March 2020. The world's changed a lot since then. 2 weeks later, and we wouldn't even be sitting in a studio together for a start. Lots of you have rightly shifted your focus to the most pressing needs of the people and communities that you serve. Others will be fighting to reshape the systems that support us all. That's why at SMK, we're now reimagining our work in this new reality. We want to keep asking how change is happening, even in extraordinary circumstances, and keep helping you to build a better future. To stay up to date on what we're doing, sign up to our newsletter at smk.org.uk. In the meantime, stay safe. If you can, stay home and enjoy our discussion about social change and the law.
How does change happen? Whether it's in public opinion, legislation, our behaviour, our communities, or just one person's life? That's the question that drives us. This is Social Power, a podcast from the Sheila McKechnie Foundation. Civil society has used the law to help drive social change for many years. For some organisations, such as South All Black Sisters and Inclusion London, the law lies at the very heart of their approach. But others feel they don't have the knowledge or resources to even consider it. Using existing law is not limited to the courtroom. It's getting a legal opinion that helps you to challenge and drive conversations with decision makers. It's providing advice or guidance that helps people uphold their own rights. And it's monitoring the way the law is implemented or how governments uphold international agreements. But today, we're looking at current trends in the use of the law and changes on the horizon. What are some of the things that today's changemakers need to be aware of? I'm Chloe Hardy, Director of Policy and Communications at the Sheila McKechnie Foundation. I'm joined by Rosemary Harris, political campaigner at Friends of the Earth.
Hello.
And Rita Chadder, Chief Executive of the Small Charities Coalition and in a previous life campaigner for migrant rights.
Hello.
So, Rita and Rosemary, it's fair to say that just as with nearly every other area of life at the moment, big change is afoot. We're leaving the EU, the last government went toe-to-toe with the Supreme Court over the legality of prorogation, and we're now told that a wholesale review of our constitution is coming. So my first quite big question is, what do you see as the emerging issues for civil society around the use of law? Rosemary?
So I think that the emerging issues kind of take on two different aspects. So you see the sort of more top-down ones that are looking at sort of fundamentally changing our constitution and the way that we interact with the law. And you can see that from kind of the way that the government is speaking about the way that the judiciary work and the Human Rights Act and things like that. But you're also seeing fundamental threats on people's right to protest and the rights of individual citizens. And that can come in the form of further criminalisation of things like trespass. It can come in the form of clampdowns on how and where people can protest. It can come in loads of forms, and I think we're going to see that both of those come together over the next year or so. And I think it's going to be a really challenging sort of atmosphere for civil society to operate in.
I think that's a really good summary of the context that we're currently working in. Are there any particular examples of the way that government or authorities have chosen to use the law or new laws coming that you at Friends of the Earth are particularly concerned about?
So one thing that we're particularly concerned about at the moment is there's a government consultation out on further criminalisation of trespass. So back in 1994, there was a new offence created of aggravated trespass, and that was created ostensibly to deal with unauthorised raves, but has been used extensively against peaceful protest and against the gypsy and traveller community. And what the government are consulting on at the moment is extending the definition of trespass and including something called trespass to remain, which would make all unauthorised encampments a criminal offence. And that is a fundamental threat to the way of life of gypsy and travellers. But it also represents a huge threat to the right to peaceful protest. And this is something that we see a lot, is the government are using a marginalised community that suffer a lot of prejudice as a way of making something seem legitimate within society. And they're using that as a shield through which to do this. They're not saying that they're coming for peaceful protest, but it will be used in that way. And you know, this is the kind of thing that we all need to come together on. So that's something that we're really concerned about and what those ramifications might be further down the line.
Brilliant. Rita, from the point of view of maybe sort of a different kind of organisation, smaller charities, are there any sort of emerging trends or issues that you're worried about?
Most definitely. I think some of the trends are about how it's not become permissible to dissent. So you have to follow a status quo, and whether you see that in the way the Charity Commission regulates or the way in which you see small charities self-censor, the law is in a completely complex area on this, and it's very difficult for small charities in particular to fathom their way around it without expert support. And that expert support, pro bono legal advice, is in great short supply. So I think there are specific challenges for small charities. What we've forgotten is that charities exist to make change. And the situation we're in at the moment means that charities feel inhibited to make that change. All they do is deliver services. I don't mean that disrespectfully. You know, there's some great organisations out there. But ultimately, we did have the concept at one stage that charities should put themselves out of business if they were successful in their mission. The only way you can often change your mission for working with some of the most vulnerable communities is if you campaign. And we don't have the resources, we don't have the expertise, and we're struggling to get support and political permission, so to speak, to actually campaign.
So underlying both of those analyses is something about the context, the story that government and other types of body are telling about dissent, about the tools of change that people should have access to. And certainly, I think that most of us will have noticed over the last maybe 6 months to 2 years, I don't really want to put a timescale on it, but more and more you hear sentences which, from the lips of politicians in particular, but also unnamed spokespeople, suggesting that, insert here, judges, people who work for public bodies, charities, civil servants are, quote, too political. Are we seeing an attempt to force people out of the political sphere? And should politics be the domain and the business only of politicians? And how far can we step into that? Should we step into that?
I would say that actually politics is everyone's business. And what we are seeing is kind of a co-option of politics at the moment, in the sense that everybody is thinking they've got the right to speak, they've got the right to talk, but within a very restricted framework. So we're controlling the debate, whether you see that on the media, whether you see that politicians. Only certain issues get prime time coverage. Only certain topics get discussed in Parliament. The right to dissent isn't anywhere on the agenda. So where do those vulnerable voices actually get to get heard? And where are those less unpopular issues? Where are the unpopular issues going to be articulated?
Turning sort of specifically to the law itself as a system, what do we see coming over the next sort of 1 to 2 years, perhaps, around the government's desire to reshape the relationship of the law to Parliament, to government, to the people who need it? I wondered if you had any particular thoughts about what was coming. Rosemary.
If I'm honest, it's quite unclear, but we're hearing noises from the government and things that they're saying. So in their manifesto, they made a commitment to a Democracy, Human Rights and Constitution Commission.
I actually have the quote here.
Oh, okay.
They are committed to establishing, quote, a Constitution, Democracy and Human Rights Commission, which will look at the relationship between the government, Parliament and the courts, the functioning of the royal prerogative, the role of the House of Lords, and access to justice for ordinary people. And I think also expected, although I can't remember exactly how it's mentioned in the manifesto, is a review of the Human Rights Act as we leave the EU. Given that the purpose of thinking about our courts is simply to ensure that the law is applied fairly and reasonably, I wonder if there are any particular aspects of a potential review, and I understand that we're just guessing what's going to be in it, that we find particularly troubling or even particularly a great opportunity for civil society.
So at Friends of the Earth, and I think from people I've spoken to across the sector, we're particularly concerned about changes that they might make to judicial reviews. They mention them in that paragraph in their manifesto, and they haven't yet announced what that's going to be. They haven't announced whether that's going to be part of the commission, or we're hearing noises that it might be fast-tracked. There are a lot of statements coming out about looking at some constitutional plumbing. whatever that means.
I'm just going to jump in here and lay out what judicial review is, because it's something that we talk about and we hear about a lot, and we hear about civil society and individuals using. So, according to the Public Law Project, judicial review is a special type of court procedure where the judge looks at a public body's decision, policy, practice, act or omission and decides whether it's lawful or not. If it isn't, the court may quash the decision or action and require the public body to reconsider it lawfully. So this is not the courts making law. This is the courts ensuring that the existing law is applied correctly.
Yeah, so essentially it's not about judges making policy or deciding government policy. It's about making sure that government and secretaries of state and ministers are acting legally. And I think sometimes that's getting lost in the conversation. And it's not... So everyone is judicially reviewing all the time, so many decisions, and it's a really important part of our process. And, you know, I'd be remiss not to mention Friends of the Earth's court case recently against the third runway at Heathrow. We took a case with Plan B, challenging the government's decision to grant the airport's national policy statement, I believe it was, to allow a third runway at Heathrow. And we challenged that on the grounds that they hadn't considered climate change or our obligations under the Paris Agreement. And we won, which is amazing. That was an incredible decision. And judges essentially ruled that the government had acted not only illegally, but irrationally in deciding that they didn't need to consider our obligations under the Paris Agreement. And the judges went to great pains during that judgment to be clear that they're not deciding government policy. They're not saying there can't be a third runway. They're saying that if the government are going to be making these decisions, they have to consider everything. It's difficult to understand why a government would be so upset at the idea that the courts are just making sure that they're doing things legally. And you hear them, the current Attorney General, just before she was appointed, Suella Braverman, in the House of Commons mentioned judicial activism. That's not a thing.
No.
That's not what judges do. And no one in government at all is yet to come up with an example that is actually concrete where judges have overstepped the mark and become political. That's never been proven.
So the Friends of the Earth court case is something with global implications, but judicial review, like you said, is happening all the time across society. And Rita, I wondered if you had any examples of how judicial review might be used to change individual or community prospects.
So in another life, when I worked for a refugee and a migrant organisation, there was the famous case of the Go Home vans that were on the streets of five London boroughs. And I was involved with the organisation that led the judicial review on that with Dayton, Pierce, Glynn as solicitors. And it worked really well. It was my first experience of a JR, judicial review, and it was in a steep learning curve, without a shadow of a doubt. But I think we're missing a trick here, because so many civil society organisations and so many funders are actually saying, well, judicial review is the halo, it's where you've got to get to. And there's so many different ways to campaign and protest, and we just don't create that space. We always go towards a judicial review. And let's be clear, just as Rosemary said, judicial review is a check and balances system. It's not the holy grail, but we sometimes see that as a default position, and that's the bit we've got to get to, when actually we could do so much more at an earlier stage. And that's what I think we've got to start focusing on, regardless of what the outcome of the review is.
I just do want to say one more thing about the judicial reviews and kind of the what that review is looking like. Again, we don't actually know anything concrete, but it's looking like what's going to happen is that they're going to look at who can and can't judicially review, and that it's going to come down to you can only bring a judicial review if you're sort of personally impacted by a decision by the government. And effectively that will stop any organisation, if they need to use judicial review as a tool, being able to do that. And in some cases it's easier to find people who are personally impacted, but when you look at climate change, are we all personally impacted, or are none of us personally impacted right now? Or if you look at the government, was particularly angry recently when a Home Office deportation flight, half the people were taken off that flight because of a successful judicial review. Who on that flight was going to be able to bring that judicial review? They're the most marginalised people in our society. None of them had access to make that judicial review. So I just think that it is a tool that we shouldn't just be relying on, but it is also something that if we remove the right down to just the person who's impacted, then it becomes so much more difficult to actually stand up for the most marginalised people.
I think that's a very good point, because also at the same time, people underestimate how difficult it is to bring together a judicial review. And especially if you're a civil society organisation, in most cases, this requires crowdfunding, it requires members to donate. It's hugely, hugely expensive. The courts aren't accessible to Joe Public.
No, not at all. I think like there's this kind of impression that's created by that, oh, we can all just click our fingers and civil society organisations can judicially review things. I mean, the stakes are high, the costs are high. It's a risky move, and it's not something that we can all just turn around and do whenever we feel like it.
So it's probably quite important for us in the coming sort of year or so that we don't allow that to become part of a narrative as well, that charities are willy-nilly just bringing judicial reviews left, right and centre, because we're actually not. You have to think about that extraordinarily carefully before you leap.
But it's also, it's difficult though, because, I mean, the government are laying, it's hard to know which of these things that are coming down the line are the ones that we should take seriously. And are we playing into the government's trap if we judicially review their review of judicial reviews?
Go down a rabbit hole and it starts to swallow its tail.
Might be necessary.
Possibly. We will find out. Before we move on, is there any other emerging issues that we want to just highlight for people, even if we can't necessarily sort of unpack them all here right now?
I haven't touched hugely on protest rights. And in addition to the changes that may come if this consultation into trespass offences, depending on what comes out of that. But there are also, we're looking at the increased labelling of environmental and other sort of campaigning groups and individuals as terrorists. So you saw Extinction Rebellion briefly and then removed from the Prevent guidance. And we've also seen the Met Police recently came out and said that they were working with the Home Office to tighten up public nuisance orders in the face of Extinction Rebellion protests. And I think that it's important that we're able to protest and exercise our right to protest. And as we do that more, the pushback is going to be more. And we all need to be able to keep standing with not just the really easy people to stand next to, but everyone. Because if we're allowing people to chip away the rights of minority groups or minor sort of fringe campaigning organisations, then we're chipping away our own rights.
I think that's absolutely true, and you see that in the migration sector constantly. Food banks started off in the migrant sector, homelessness was a bigger issue in the migrant sector, and then it all seeps out into the wider public. And I think there's also the issue that when you do have minority groups or marginalised groups affected, there is a tendency for government to also now divide and rule. And that's especially true of the migration sector, where you see communities pitted against one another. And I think we're going to see more of those narratives emerging in popular discourse, which is going to be of great concern, because how do we challenge that?
So solidarity is the emerging word here?
Without a shadow of a doubt. If we don't stand together now, there will be no tomorrow.
Well, that brings me actually quite neatly onto my second question. What might this mean in the wider context of closing civic space? And in particular, what should and could civil society's response to these slightly uncertain potential threats, also potential opportunities, be?
I think we've got to be bolder. And I know that's easier to say than do. But there is a sense where we have got to understand that there is a diverse civil society out there. And let me be absolutely clear, one of the things that shocked me when I first joined Small Charities Coalition, and I come from a campaigning background and am personally quite on the left, was I had just a natural assumption that all civil society was also automatically on the left. Well, it isn't. And I feel there's a strong obligation to defend the rights of those who I wouldn't automatically agree with, because we must protect their right to speak, regardless of whether it's comfortable or palatable for us as individuals. We are in danger, even in the UK, of losing freedom of speech.
That's an interesting take, and makes that solidarity all the more important.
Absolutely.
To make sure it's really broad church.
I completely agree, and I think that the need to know where our lines are as organisations and as a sector, and to firmly stick to those, is really important, and to be loud and speak out about what's going on and actively push against it. That it's easy for kind of vague threats of changes or things that might happen to us to keep everyone quiet, because if we behave then everything will be fine. But that's kind of clearly been shown not to be the case. It's the threats are becoming quicker and bigger. But I also think that we do need to stand together and we need to speak out. And we also need to, kind of to build on Rita's point, we also need to, the larger organisations or the organisations that have a more easy voice in society need to think about where they can be helpful and where they can be heard. There are organisations and charities that can't speak out or speak for marginalised people or are so squeezed in terms of where they can fundraise because of different restrictions on them, that if they speak out at all, it might mean that the services they provide just can't be provided. And so organisations that have that buffer and have that ability, even if the threats aren't going to impact them, need to think about what they can do and what they can bring to it. In addition to that, if you look at the case of the deportation flight that recently happened, it's very easy to use a narrative when it's sort of the Windrush generation. It's very easy for that narrative to be, oh, these are people who came over and contributed to the economy. And it's the sort of worthy narrative.
It's the good versus bad migrant narrative.
Yeah, the good, bad migrant narrative. And I think that we still have to stand up for the people who maybe don't fit into that good migrant narrative as much. Yes, those people had committed crimes, but they'd also served their sentence and some of them had been here since they were five. It's difficult, it's more challenging, but I think we as a sector need to be really clear that we don't just stand up when it's easy. We stand up when it's hard and it's less popular.
So I'm hearing solidarity. I'm hearing that as a sector, as the broadest possible definition of civil society, we should be having very conscious conversations with each other about what's coming, what our experiences are, what challenges we're facing, particularly with regard to these reviews and things we know are bubbling up.
And I think there's space also there for us to be a bit more creative. So at the moment, all the discussions that happen about social change happen at the national level. And that's a real issue because so many charities actually work at the local level. And you don't often hear about the small local charities actually taking campaigns to their local council. Yes, they may lobby in a very certain space as it affects them, but you don't hear about broad-based campaigns at the very local level. And I think we've got to start building, especially with smaller charities, that capacity to understand the structures and the powers around them and that they are allies, they are individuals affected in that space, and that local is just as important as the national, because I do have a theory that actually the local, if you build up enough of a critical mass, does influence the national as well.
SMK, just as an aside, so we do go out and we've been doing some training and capacity building with local and neighbourhood organisations, and what's really interesting is that I can stand in a room with a large national charity and with a neighbourhood group, share with them our model, our conception of social power and how we think it operates, and both parties get it. You can then start moving into more specific conversations about how do we interact with local government, how do we interact with the law, and those conversations absolutely have a very similar basis. So we're kind of looking for this shared understanding from which we can proceed to understanding how we can support each other and work together much better. I completely agree. And then we also heard from Rosemary about the importance of people who have power, whether that's economic power, voice, resource, knowledge, to be much more conscious and generous about sharing that. So I wonder as well, we've been talking specifically about civil society, and I wonder whether these prospective either changes that are coming to our legal system or the way that the law is being used now, whether there are any links that we can build outside of civil society into other sectors or other parts of society, if anything springs to mind.
I think there's a huge space here also to be more innovative with corporate social responsibility. And I think there is a willingness from some corporates, at least, to acknowledge that actually their employees, their beneficiaries, the people, their customers are part of a community that is affected and needs change. And I think if we can build strong alliances with business, that may be an easier sell to government in some cases than civil society by itself. But having said that, it's also something that's not very palatable, and civil society doesn't tend to have the expertise it needs to work with businesses. It's usually a one-way pro bono relationship. So we have to do more in that space as well. And after all, that is in the civil society strategy, that the voluntary sector should work much closer with business anyway. But we need to think carefully about that relationship we can move it beyond donations and volunteering.
So do either of you see any potential in terms of the commercial sector recognising that any review of our legal system might impact them or their customers? Do you think it's something that they're ready to talk about?
I think if you take the parallel with Brexit and how the corporate sector have stepped up and said that their workforce is going to be impacted, their ability to deliver is going to be impacted. And I think if we can draw out parallel arguments with the review, then I think we can make an argument that actually corporates are going to be equally affected because they're members of the community. But I think it's going to be a hard sell. And we're working in such vague circumstances until the government actually puts into place what it's actually going to do and articulates it clearly.
That's really helpful. I'm going to wrap up the conversation, but I want to give each of you an opportunity to say whether there's a particular takeaway. If I'm a campaigner or a change maker sitting listening to this podcast, this is all news to me. What's the one thing that you would like us to take away from this conversation? Maybe go and find out more about.
I would say don't let anybody put you off campaigning. Use what you know as the basis and work with allies. Whether you don't agree with them on anything, it doesn't matter if you don't agree with them on everything. What matters is that you agree with them on the point that you're trying to campaign about. Build that solidarity from the beginning, but also invest in yourself when you're campaigning. It takes a lot out of an individual to be a campaigner, personally and professionally, and be prepared for that. But if you get it right, the rewards are enormous.
Oh, there's so many takeaways I have. I think if you're an individual campaigner and you're part of a grassroots organisation, or you're thinking about becoming part of a grassroots organisation, or you just want to go and join a protest march, just keep doing what you're doing. You're great. And also don't let narratives around radicalisation put you off. I think if you're sort of part of a larger organisation, think about where you can be an ally and where you can stand with smaller or more marginalised organisations. Think about where your interests lie, but also think about where you sit in a wider movement. We're all part of a wider movement and we're all moving towards the same thing. And if we start letting pieces of us be chipped away, then we're just going to be left standing by ourselves in 20 years and climate will have changed.
That's a very good point, although slightly extremely depressing.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Yeah. Okay, so I think maybe what I would say probably echoes both of you in a way, which is that a lot of changes are coming. Even if you don't use the law in your everyday to day campaigning, you still want the option of doing it should the situation arise. So do think of yourself as part of a wider movement, part of a broader civil society. Keep an eye on these things. Lots of organisations are going to be actively and directly working on them, but just keep yourself informed. And at some point, I have no doubt over the next year or so, you will be invited to add your voice to other people's. And please feel that you can step forward and do that. Whether or not your organisation is a major or user of the law, it will affect you eventually, the people you work with, and your peers in the sector. So I just wanted to say a really big thank you to both Rita and Rosemary for coming in and having this conversation.
Thank you. Thank you.
SMK will be keeping an eye on things, and as details emerge, we'll try and make sure that we keep all of our supporters up to date, and I'm sure lots of organisations like Friends of the Earth and Small Charities Coalition will be doing the same. Thanks again to our guests and to the Baring Foundation for supporting SMK's work on social change in the law for the past 6 months. SMK has produced a free and accessible guide to different ways that you can use the law and ways that you may be able to pay for it, which you can find at smk.org.uk/law. And you can sign up to our newsletter to follow the latest developments in this and other social change issues. You've been listening to Social Power, a podcast from the Sheila McKechnie Foundation. If you enjoyed it, please share it with a friend or a colleague, and please rate and review it so others can find us more easily.